Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So, this is the Bitcoin Formula, episode 1. Welcome again, Datavetaren.
Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, too. I'd like to talk about the sort of the most important question around Bitcoin. What it is. What is Bitcoin today? And to understand Bitcoin, it's a good thing to try to understand money first, right? What is money? So let's go back in time and talk about what is money. Where did it come from?
Well, money is an interesting concept because it's actually extremely old.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
It's like 25,000 years ago.
Yeah.
There are historical records that people were using something to keep track of debt.
Yeah.
So when they...
For instance, the island of Jap.
That is one example, but yeah. It goes even further back in time when you had people were hunting and they were killing a buffalo or something. Yeah. And then that hunter could possibly not eat the whole buffalo himself. So no. You have to eat some of it and give away some of the meat to someone else in the tribe, and you have to keep track of how much meat everybody ate, so that the next time the other hunter gets a buffalo, you have to know how much meat you can get back.
Yeah.
So keeping track of debt was actually the first use case of money, and that happened like 25,000 years ago.
Yeah, probably we don't know that exactly, but I mean. It's a replacement for bartering, to barter stuff, to make a trade, be able to delay a trade, or make a trade over a bigger distance, for instance.
When you say bartering, I think most people think about bartering in terms of, you know, using another thing as an exchange. But if you're referring to bartering as something that you can exchange for an event that will happen in future, then yes, then you could view money as bartering, because it's not real physical tangible things that you barter with, but you barter with debt that some can happen sometime in the future, right? So so in the case of the buffalo, what you give me is something that I can keep track of, so I can give you that back and get meat later on, right? That's kind of a trade, settle in into the future.
But do we have a debt involved in this one?
According to anthropologists, money was started with debt. I mean, all historical records show that money started with some kind of debt. But I think that's
it's an IOU.
Yeah.
A record. Let's talk about those stones. A very long time ago on an island, some peoples were using very big stones. And on these stones, they carved out their holdings, more or less. And they could sort of switch holdings or transfer holdings between these stones, and somebody guarded the stones. It's pretty similar to the blockchain of Bitcoin.
Yeah, so this is another thing. This is on the island of Jap, right? That's when...
And human beings have, all through time, just invented different forms of money automatically. It's a natural thing to do,
I think that money has... there are different forms of money, right? There are these giant stones where you carve in what are your holdings, and there are these smaller stones that you use to trade with to keep track of debt. And then you have another form of money is something that is proved to have a lot of work behind it, like digging gold from the ground that you know it's scarce, and therefore it has some value because it's difficult to extract from the Earth's crust. And that is also some form of money because there, it's kind of a this proof of work behind it to grab it out of the ground. So,
yeah, but it's also scarce.
It's also scarce, but yeah, but it's...
But there are many different concepts in this area, like hard money or intrinsic value or legal tender. And gold is something you often call hard money, right?
Yeah, well,
because it's not a debt, usually. Yeah. The actual money, the actual... So thing you're using for money is not a debt.
Yeah,
it's not an IOU.
Yeah, that's true. So there are different kinds of money, I would say, right?
Yeah.
So I think there are two different camps here in economy. I mean, if you track the historical records of money, the initial use case of money was to keep track of debt. But that doesn't mean that's the only form of money. There are other kinds of money, right? There's gold that is money, and it's scarce, and it's difficult. The reason why gold is money is because if anything would be money, if it was very easy to access, then everybody would have infinite amount of money, and then the concept of money would be useless, right? Because the interesting aspect about using something that is scarce is that it's a very new, it's a neat way of decentralize a blockchain, right? It's a nice way of decentralizing keeping track of things.
Yeah, because everybody knows there's just a finite amount of this.
Yeah, because then you know that no one else can just invent or create money for himself to buy things.
That's why
people,
gold has been 6,000 years now.
Yeah, people would count that as unfair if a random person can just invent money and then go and buy things. And there's no proof of work behind it, so all of these things, where is money a commodity or is it debt or whatever? There are different kinds of money.
Exactly.
And I think that it would be unfair to say that this is money and this is not money. I mean, money as a concept has changed through time, and there are, and money has evolved into different stages. And sometimes it goes back to a different form, and sometimes it takes a leap to another form.
Yeah, but this is not the general sort of perception among people, because I meet with many people at banks and talking to representatives for banks, and they don't know often where money comes from.
Because money is very tricky,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because it depends what you're talking about. First, if someone says, what is money? Well, define it first, right? Because there are different kinds of money, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason why gold is a good money, it used to be, is that it's universally scarce, right? So that has some unique properties. And it's universally scarce in a way that it doesn't rust.
Yeah.
It preserves itself.
It's the same for everybody in the world at all times.
Yeah, and so I would say that money today is very different from what money used to be, right? And money keeps evolving all the time to different forms, and it depends on what people invent and what people thinks it is fair, etc. Right?
Yeah. So what happened in the history of money, monetary history? What happened later on was that coins were invented, like gold coins, for instance.
Yeah, but there were different kinds of money. If you go back to, like, say, Europe during this is not particularly related to Europe, but this is the piece of history I know, is that in the 16th century in Europe, there were two forms of money. There were private money, which were wealthy families. They had a lot of wealth stored in gold and other things. And they issued bills of exchange that said that, well, it's an IOU that you can use. And these started to circulate outside these families, right? So they became tokens of money, right? Because everybody knew that these wealthy families, they were behind this token. So I could always go and redeem that token to gold or whatever that...
Yeah, they backed it.
They backed
with
it.
With the other resources they had.
With other resources they had. And exactly the same thing was for kings and or other, you know, depending on...
So the country owners.
The country
the
owners.
Owners,
the landowners. The king itself could also issue money, and it also had the ability to tax, right? So it could collect money from wealth from the people.
Yeah.
And so the king issued tokens as well, right? And
usually through a monopoly of violence.
Yeah,
or
so
monopoly on violence.
Yeah, so what the king did was he could establish something called legal tender.
Exactly. Yeah.
Saying that these tokens I will give to the people, you can use these tokens to buy things from merchants on my land. And they are not even allowed to decline that. If they do, we're going to chop their heads off because they're illoyal to the king, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everybody has to be loyal to the king.
Yeah.
So there were these two kinds of money, and it was like a power struggle, right? You have the wealthy families with their belts of exchange, and you had the king who forced his money.
Yeah, but it's still built on trust. The ones using the money have to trust the people
issuing
the money.
Not in the case of public money. That was backed by violence, right? If you don't accept the money, you could be...
In the long run, but I mean, in a daily sort of daily life, you trust that this money will still be worth something tomorrow.
Yeah, in the terms of the king, so the public money, then you, if the king...
It is still fiat money. I mean, this concept of fiat, we haven't explained that either. We need to talk about fiat.
Yeah, so this is, again, the difference between the money, the two different monies that existed in the 16th century of Europe, is that you have the private money, right, with the bills of exchange that circulated, and then you had the money of the king, which wasn't really backed by anything except by violence, right? If you don't accept it, you can get, you know, you can get killed, right?
But the both fiat money, both types of money, is fiat money, right? It's invented out of thin air by somebody who says this is worth something. You have to trust
it. It's true, but one of the money, the private money, could default, right? Because if you had this bills of exchange and this wealthy family, which happened time to time, that they were, you know, gambling away all their wealth, and then you came with the bill of exchange, and then I want to redeem this for what it was worth. And
then the trust was gone.
And the trust was gone, and so they could default, right? Mm. But the king's money, that can never happen, because through the monopoly of the king, he could say that merchants must accept this thing. Of course, this is not the entire truth, because if people do not trust the king, then the money defaults as well, right? And at the time, there was a struggle between two camps. You had a camp that said that money should be worth its own weight, right? If there's silver in the money, it was usually silver coins, in at least in England. It should be worth what the silver content is of that coin, right? That was one camp. But the other camp said that this is just an abstract token, and if you do not accept it, the king will chop your head off, and so you would have to accept it, and the king says that it has this value, and if you don't accept it, you will get killed.
Yeah.
And of course...
One of the problems with the coins were the people sort of scraping away...
The problem with coins that had intrinsic value, so-called intrinsic value, where they have silver contents, they will do exactly what you say. They will chop off a little bit piece of silver and then pass the coin along, and then finally you could get another coin by the contents of things that you have taken away from the
other
coins.
There we get into this concept of intrinsic value, because that's something people, modern economists, often talk about, that Bitcoin does not have intrinsic value, it's not useful.
But nothing has intrinsic value, really. Yeah, because
gold is something we just invented. Well, it has some value in the industry, but not much.
The industrial value is far less than the actual value of gold. Yeah, the gold.
But the concept of intrinsic value, it means that the money you're using has some sort of built-in other type of value than being a mechanism for trade
or
store of value.
But that's not really true, right?
Because it's just a theory.
Nothing has intrinsic value, because everything, all value is based on supply and demand.
Yeah.
If everybody would stop believing in gold...
Yeah, nobody would buy it.
Nobody would use gold anymore. Nobody would accept gold anymore. And gold, the price of gold is fluctuating, right?
Yeah.
It depends how much...
It's a bubble. It's a 6,000-year-old bubble.
Yeah, but there are some properties with gold that makes it unique, right? It's finite. There's finite supply, and as long as there's some demand, it will have some value, right?
But let's go back to the 15th century.
Yeah, the 16th century and the 17th century.
It was a historical event, 1694, right?
1694, that's the end of the 17th century. That's one of the most important things that happened, because you had this...
Yeah, for the modern economy.
Yeah, for the modern economy. Because you had the private money with the people of wealth, and you have the king's money, the public money.
This was in England.
It was in England, and it was enforced through, well, ultimately through violence, right? You will prove disloyal to the king.
The king had a problem with money. He needed more money, right?
The problem here is that people sometimes go back and forth between private and public money, and depending on where the most trust word, right? At this time, when there was a lot of wars, usually the king debased the value by reducing the content of silver in the coins. Yeah. And people were kind of unhappy about that, because they started to differentiate the money between the amount of silver in the coin. Oh, right? Yeah. If they used the coins to pay taxes with the coins that had less silver in them, right? So
that was the sort of inflation then.
Yeah, well, but the money didn't become that fungible anymore, which is an important concept of money, that there shouldn't be no distinction between two coins, right? Yeah. Because then trade will suffer if it's not fungible. So all these wars mean that people were losing trust in the king's money, right? And you can't kill all the people that live in your country, right? So that's when the money of the king defaults, right? That people loses trust in the king's money, so they go back to the private money. So the king understood this, and he had to rebuild his fleet to pursue France.
Yeah.
So he needed money, and nobody was no longer using the king's money. So he basically had to go to the wealthy families and ask for a loan. But they didn't want to lend. They thought that the king was not credit worthy. And so what happened then was an interesting change in history. So the king said, okay, let's make a deal. You have money, the private money, that can default, and you have experienced problems with that. Because if there's a bank run, you go bankrupt, right? I have money that cannot default, because I can guard it with my soldiers, right? Yeah. So I can kill the merchants who do not accept it. So let's go together and build a new bank, the central bank, or the Bank of England, where the wealthy families become stakeholders. And then you grant me a loan, and then people have no choice, right? There are no distinction between the private money and the public money. So there's no choice. So the king, by creating the Bank of England, the people were forced to use this new money.
And the so-called legal tender, then.
The legal tender types of money, where you fuse the private money with the public money, so they become one.
Yeah.
And that's basically what the money is today.
Yeah, because that was the first central bank in the world, in England.
No, in England, Swedish. Yeah. No, Sweden was before that. But the England, the history of the central bank in England is very clear, where you invite the wealthy families to become stakeholders into the bank. This has happened many times before. It has happened with the Federal Reserve in the U.S., It's a very smart way of gaining trust from the private wealthy families, and at the same time the government can get stronger, right? They empower, they get more power by doing so.
Yeah. But so the system of today, it builds on an event that happened in 1694, with the king sort of issued pounds, British pounds, and people started using them because they had to use them.
There's no choice.
No.
Yeah.
And this system proved to be very successful for England, or for the king at least. So people started to copy it in other countries.
Yes. Successful because, it
fitted together with the...
The king gets more power, the wealthy family gets more power, everybody gets power that are rich.
The power, the people in power got more power.
Exactly.
Which they like that, of course.
They like that, of course. And people who doesn't have power, they get less power, actually.
Yeah.
Because they have no more choice.
And that's the same system we have today.
It's the same system we have today. It's calibrated a little bit, right? Yeah. Because the problem... So what happened with the central bank is that if there is a bank run, and then the central bank is the lender of last resort, which can always create more money and give it to banks in terms of loans, of course, but it doesn't matter. That's an abstract thing. So it means that the bank can always have... can always issue money in worst case, right? So if they can always grant loans to new customers because they can always relend from the central bank. Yeah. So if there's a run, if there's a public bank run, then well, then they can just take more loan from the central bank. Yeah. But what that means is that the risk of the private banks, if they issue credit that exceeds their funds or whatever, is that the risk is then spread on the sovereign, on all of us. So the taxpayers or the people of England is used as an asset for these private corporations, which banks are. And I because when you fuse the public and private money, previously there was a risk involved holding private money. That risk is now gone, right? When they created a central bank.
Yeah.
But then they calibrated this because obviously it's not a good thing that all risk-taking of a bank becomes public. Because that's very dangerous because then, of course, banks will create infinite amount of money for themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's why this has been calibrated so that there's an upper bound how much sovereign money is backing the private money, the credit that the banks create.
Yeah.
And in Europe, it's 100,000 euros per account. And which means that...
You're talking about the guarantee on people,
what kind of money people
have in the accounts.
So if there's a bank run and the bank goes down, then the entire risk of what the bank has created with credit is not exposed to the public domain. Only a fraction of it is. That's the purpose of this.
In theory,
yeah. Yes, exactly. Because what happens is that
in
these
reality,
banks
they can't do that. Can't bail all the banks out. Look at Cyprus, for instance.
The problem is that what happens is that banks become so powerful so that it will hurt the economy. So governments feel that they have no choice than just bailing out the banks, right? And now this has become a problem. Because if this happens too often, people will get very upset, of course, because it's transferring the risk of the bank to the public, and the public is right to be angry about that.
Yeah.
And having this, you know, this upper limit has its problems as well, because then the banks will go down and that could hurt the economy, right?
Yeah.
So,
but in real terms, why is that a bad system for people? Well, a part of it is because it affects inflation. It makes the number of units in any currency, they grow the number of units to counteract the problems with the risks that have been taken by the banks due to the losses.
But they're growing the...
So everybody loses.
So, right? So credit money that is on the bank is different from the sovereign money that the central bank has, right?
Yeah.
Credit is much bigger than the sovereign money, because sovereign money is not backing the full credit. If it did, then... Every time the bank issues more credit, then the entire risk of that is exposed to the public. You don't want that, because then banks can create money for themselves, which is a bad thing. I mean, everybody would agree that it would be a bad thing.
Well, banks do create money today, right?
They create credit, right?
Credit.
And credit
is a type of money today.
It's a type of money today, but if there's a bank run, if the bank goes down, then not all the credit... are going to be redeemable money. Only the central bank money is going to be redeemable. And central bank has said that there's an upper limit how much we're going to pay out to bank holders, right? So you have this hybrid, right? Where you say it's not this fully thing where you say the central bank is the lender of last resort for all our circumstances. There's an upper bound what they are allowed to do. And that's in theory, because in practice, they've always been bailing out. And that's also a bad thing.
We've seen many examples in many countries where the central banks are printing too much money.
Yeah, well, but this is another thing. So what happens is that if the central bank doesn't stick with its ID and just says, we're going to back all the credit, which is has happened in the US, for instance. They just stepped in and printed money and said that we're going to cover your credit no matter what because you are systemic. You're too important to go down.
Yeah, since 2008.
And when you do that, then you transfer the loss of a private corporation to the public.
Yeah.
And people get upset about that, and they are right to be upset about that. And so what is the alternative then? And there have been different kind of proposals how to counter
the Chicago plan.
I'm not going to talk about Chicago plan right now. I was thinking about something else.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the recent thing where you say a bail-in, where the account holders will basically lose some of their credit. So
that happened in Cyprus.
That's the new model, actually.
Yeah.
But that's going to be problematic because if that happens too often as well, then people will lose trust in banks.
Yeah.
And so what is the best system here? In the recent years, there have been some leading economists. I'm talking about, for instance, Michael Kumhoff at the IMF. He proposed that this kind of debate we have today happened before in 1930s, which was at the University of Chicago.
You mean the debate of the day since 2008, more or less?
Yes. The most recent debate in 2000 that happened after 2008, where basically the government bailed out the banks.
Yeah.
And
they doubled a number of units of the US
dollar.
And
at that time, they were actually letting the banks go default, right? And that has problems as well.
Yeah.
So the question is, what can we do? What is a compromise between these two things?
Mm.
And so the Chicago plan was an idea by leading economists at the time who proposed that we need... What happened with the central bank in 1694 in England, in Bank of England, was not a very good idea.
No.
Because we need to make sure that private corporations have risk. And the But we don't want systemic risk.
We
want to separate
talk about
them.
Fractional reserve banking here too, because that's how they create new money. Also, that's one way they create new money. When a bank creates a loan for a new property, for instance, the difference between the old value and the new value can be seen as new money.
Yeah, but that's exactly how. Fractional reserve has basically always existed. Since the beginning of time. The difference here is that...
Well, yeah, but we have to talk about what is fractional reserve banking.
Yes.
That is when a bank creates a loan and have the property as a security for the loan, for instance.
Yeah.
And they extend this debt or the credit to the loaner. And this credit is created on base of that security.
Yes.
So that's the way they create new money.
Yeah.
Out of thin air, more or less.
Yes.
But still we have an increased value maybe of the property. So it's some part of that money is actually has a real value in this world. But still they are creating money and the money supply is growing.
Yeah, they create credit, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the question is credit money? And today it is, because people accept credit as payment.
Yeah, they package as loans and sell them to other people, etc.
Yeah, but you use your credit card when you pay things and you go to a restaurant. So
so
credit has become some sort of accepted money. But
fractional reserve banking was illegal during certain times in
areas. But this is, again, before...
Yes.
The central bank, before the invention of the central bank.
But even in the 19th century, it was illegal in some areas, like in the States, for instance.
I mean, fractional bank, before the central bank.
Yeah. So the bank did not have a right to lend out more money.
No, the private, they could, right? And they could issue bills of exchange that were not redeemable. They could default, right? So there was a risk holding that money. In certain areas, that was considered illegal, right? But it's a definition. Is it illegal or not? I mean, if you understand that this bill of exchange may not be redeemable, then, well, it's your own, it's on your own risk, right? To accept that kind of money, right?
Yeah, and that's also a current question on Iceland. And in Switzerland, they are talking about and maybe even voting about not allowing the banks to create money this way anymore.
Yeah.
Right? This is something happening right now.
Yeah, well, there are different kinds of happening. So if we go back to the Chicago plan,
yep.
what we want to do here is that we want to separate the private corporations and the public money so they are not fused together anymore, right? So you will say that private money, you can use it, but it's on your own risk. And then you have public money, you can use it, but because it's backed by the state, by the government, you can redeem it because it's legal tender, you can buy things with it. That's never going to default because we make it so, we say it so, right? And so then private money can then still be used, but we separate these two things again. And so that's basically what Chicago plan is, but it's not really that. It's basically creating a new certain institutions of banks that are not allowed to issue more credit than the sovereign money. They are only allowed to act as an intermediary,
yeah.
which means that they are allowed to pass along the sovereign money. They are not allowed to create new one, right? So yeah. you have a network with institutions that only does this, nothing else. So basically what that means is that they are not allowed to use fractional reserve. They are not allowed to issue more credit than they have backing for.
Yeah.
And then you have the other network of banks, which basically operate as they do today, right? So this is basically what the Chicago plan is that you try to separate these things too, because then the private network with the private banks, as they work today, they can then default because they will no longer be systemic. Because you can still go to the restaurant, you can still go to the grocery store, pay with your money, the money will never disappear, they will always be there. And the government, if they choose to, they can inflate it, they can issue more money and then pass it along to this network of new banks.
Yeah.
And this is called a narrow banking system.
Yeah.
And so now the next question is, how is this related to Bitcoin?
Yeah, what right? is Bitcoin?
What is
is it gold or like gold or is it like cash? What is cash?
Yeah,
cash is paper notes.
Those are usually paper notes, but those are sovereign money always.
Yeah.
It's always issued by the central bank.
Well, no, there are private monies on notes around the world still today.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not illegal even. People believe they're illegal,
yes,
but they're
not. Yes, that's true. That's yeah. true. But
no, okay, 99% is legal tender.
Yeah. When you come to legal tender money, which means that you can take your physical note and go to a grocery store and use it. They are not allowed to say you can't use it. Well, they are. They can say.
Yeah, more or less.
Well, okay, let's go to a restaurant instead. You have your meal, and you're done, and you're gonna leave, and you're gonna pay for your
then
meal.
Then they have to accept.
They have to accept it.
But
they
if they ask you in beforehand what kind of money you have, they can say no, right?
They can say no. Yeah, that's
at least
true.
In Sweden, that's probably the right thing.
It could be different in different. No, there are different kinds of. There are different rules in different kinds of the world and different parts of the world. So what is then Bitcoin? What relation does it have to, let's say, you know, private money and public money?
There's so many differences. Let's say one of the differences are that you don't have a central authority that can print the money at will. That's a very big difference.
But the interesting aspect of Bitcoin is that it cannot default in its own account.
Yeah.
The 10 Bitcoins that you have will always be there.
Yeah,
you can always spend them.
Yeah, there's no debt involved here. This is a commodity, more or less.
Yeah,
you create this.
But it can never default because unless the entire Bitcoin network defaults, I mean, it goes away, then it defaults.
But as long as
the network is there, you can always use it. The question is, what value will it have? Well, value
that's
is relative. That's relative to other things. But Bitcoin in itself will never default.
Yeah.
So that's the interesting aspect of it. So, which makes it very similar to public sovereign money, which also cannot
but a global
default.
Sort of type of, or it's not really related to any.
It's not related to anything, but it cannot default, right? Unless the entire Bitcoin network defaults. But private money is usually backed by something, backed by wealth, or even, you know, you go to a pub and you have some kind of tokens that you can use to buy beers with.
Yeah.
That is a local community money. But what happens if that pub goes away? Well, then the money becomes worthless, right? You can't use it anymore.
Yeah.
But with Bitcoin, that never happens, right? Because as long as the network is there and people are all around the world, if you have balance, Bitcoin balance, you can always use it.
Yeah.
So,
but if we summarize sort of different types of money before we go onto Bitcoin, Bitcoin is created through this network, all these nodes that are so-called miners. These miners are searching for a very difficult to find solution to confirm the next block of transactions. They use something called proof of work, which proves that a number of computers have worked a lot, spent a lot of energy to mint each Bitcoin. So they are sort of transferring or converting energy into a digital commodity. So if you compare to fiat money, which is created out of thin air at will, somebody says that we're going to create this money, and people believe in that, have a trust in that. This kind of money is more like gold in that sense, as you have to sort of dig it out of the digital world or cyber world. But it's not, it is not exactly the same as gold, of course. You can divide, you can make very small units very easily, and you can send it over email.
Well, you can do that with gold too, but not the email, but you can divide it up into gold atoms.
You can, but it's very much more, you know, troublesome.
Yeah.
To weigh them and stuff.
Yeah, it's hard when you get to individual atoms.
Yeah. But the main objection you get from people when you start talking about Bitcoin is that, oh, how can that have any value? It's just digital, you can just copy it. But we talked about it in the last episode, how, you know, we can't copy.
Well, gold has no value either. It's just there's nothing that has intrinsic value, right? So it's all based on trust, right? But Bitcoin has this fantastic property that gold also has, that first of all, there's a finite supply. At least if you aggregate, if you take all the money that will exist for its entire history, then it's a fixed money supply. So that's kind of interesting, right? That's an interesting aspect of Bitcoin, which makes it
similar to gold.
It makes it similar to gold,
At least until we start mining gold on asteroids and stuff. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that, in that regard, Bitcoin is even more finite than gold, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You're more valuable in the long run.
In the long run. So if you get visited by aliens that comes with their saucers in gold and land on the earth, then we have problems.
But listen, the algorithm and the Bitcoin network.
Yeah.
The very interesting thing about it is that you don't have connections to the real world outside, you know, we have to sell Bitcoin to pay your electricity bill if you're a miner. But other than that, Bitcoin is sort of very much integrated. You don't need any connections. You can't attack Bitcoin because it's not connected to other things in the world.
Yeah, so the interesting aspect is that the other interesting aspect of Bitcoin is the transferability, that you can transfer across the globe, right? So first of all,
network,
the transaction network. Yeah. So first of all, you have this thing that cannot default, right? It can only default if everybody stops believing in it.
If everybody stops their machines that run.
You close down the internet or whatever.
And today we have between 50,000 and 100,000 nodes running this network.
No. It's about a couple of thousand.
Oh, sorry, between 5,000 and 10,000.
No, I think it's more like 3,000 or something like that.
Depends on which monitor you check.
Well,
there's some say about 5,000, some up to 10,000.
Okay.
I have a list of monitors.
All right. So anyway.
Yeah, but these nodes, nodes run the network. These nodes, this is how you sort of propagate transactions all over the world. And these nodes, you don't need this many nodes that we have today to run the network. We could have much less nodes than 5,000.
So there are different people who have different opinions about how many nodes there should be, of course.
Yeah.
But if you ask me what is my opinion, and I think that because of the proof of work, that's the most interesting aspect of Bitcoin, because it makes it possible for you to basically identify if you are on the right chain or not.
Yeah, but let's talk about proof of work and how it started. Because it started in 2009, in January.
Yes.
It's the so-called Genesis block. Yes. Satoshi Nakamoto, he wrote a white paper.
Yes.
And then he wrote the first client, the first code.
Yeah.
And in that code, we have the word blockchain.
Yeah.
Right. So in 2009, the first block was created. And since then, we have created new blocks that build on the last block, the previous block.
Yes.
So now we're in 2015, and we're block number 400,000 soon, or something like that.
Well, soon enough, it will be, yeah.
So what is Bitcoin then?
Yeah, I would say that Bitcoin is the longest chain with the most proof of work behind it.
Yeah, these machines that are searching for these blocks, they expend energy to create this proof of work.
Yeah, and they always use the tip. They all miners attempt to take the tip of the chain and tag on their block on it.
Yeah.
And some sometimes there is a draw, right? But eventually one chain will always be the longest.
Yeah, the most proof of the most work.
And the longest chain is usually, but not always, because you can imagine that you take the Genesis block and you create some spoof long chain with almost no proof of work behind it that is longer than the current longest chain. But that then there is this additional constraint saying that the chain with the most proof of work behind it, that's the chain, that's Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So anything else is not going to be Bitcoin, because that's the chain that guarantees that your money does not default. Because everybody will only accept the chain with the most proof of work behind it.
And why is that important? Because you can copy the code. You can make so-called altcoins.
Yes. You have other coins. You can do whatever you want with a code, but there will only be one chain with the most proof of work behind it, and that is Bitcoin. Which means that it doesn't matter how many nodes there are, because you will always be able to identify the longest or the chain with the most proof of work behind it.
Yeah.
So you can know if you are getting spoofed when you connect to the internet and you access a node. You can know whether that node is trying to fake a chain that is not the longest chain with the most proof of work behind it, because you can somehow guess what the longest chain should be at this very moment, right?
Yeah, and there are many monitors online. You can go and check those.
Yeah. Yeah, so, well, first of all, you can use different nodes, but if your entire network is spoofed, you can still somehow get a hunch that something bad is going on here.
Hmm.
And so I would say that the number of nodes is not super important, but of course, you need at least as many nodes.
The hashing power is important.
Hashing power is extremely important, and you need at least as many nodes as there are miners, because every miner would presumably, unless they collude, they presumably want to have their own node, right, to send their transactions on. And then there are probably companies that are, you know, doing Bitcoin transactions. There are wallet providers.
Or analysis. Or
there are like analysis, and there we have BitPay and, you know, merchants and stuff. They may also want to have nodes.
Vaults,
But then you can, but for other people, like, you know, for you and me that has something on your phone and you just want to broadcast, we don't need a full node. We need just a thin node, right?
Yeah. When you say broadcast, you mean actually transact.
Send transactions. Exactly. Send transactions is what is called broadcasting.
Yeah, but why do we talk about that the longest chain or the chain with the most of work is Bitcoin? Well, because there's a debate going on right now on...
Yeah, so there's a power struggle between different kind of developers that some say that Bitcoin should go in this direction, it should use this protocol and these changes, and another team is saying that, well, we don't want to go that direction, we want to go this direction instead. And ultimately, who determines what is going to be Bitcoin is the one who can get the most hash power. And it doesn't matter if you like it or not. That's the definition of Bitcoin. And it's very clear that Satoshi himself stated that. And
yeah, that miners will always be able, should always be able to sort of vote on the
miners development. Miners are ultimately those who will say what is Bitcoin.
And I agree on that. I think that's a good thing. I think miners are the ones that should be in charge.
But there's an economics incentive here, right? Yeah. Because miners, they don't want to, you know, random thing, because they want to have, they want to make sure that exchanges and merchants, they are on the same pace, because otherwise
the whole system has to work.
Because if the miners just go in one direction and they don't care about anything, then their money that they mine will become worthless. Yeah. So it's not in their own interest to pick whatever rules, but they have to be a collaboration between
The choices they make is to uphold or increase the value of Bitcoin. Bitcoin.
That's an economic incentive, right?
Yeah.
To them to pick something that is good for all of us. So I would say that miners, exchanges, and companies that work in the Bitcoin sphere, they together, but ultimately miners has the final vote, what is Bitcoin, right? And developers shouldn't have that power that they think they have, because they should listen to these key players, because they determine what is Bitcoin. And
the so-called economic majority. I mean,
the economic majority.
Everybody involved in running.
Exactly, because Bitcoin. Developers are just should... according to my opinion, they should just provide what is being asked for. Right?
Yeah, or suggestions.
They could do, but also from the other way, right? From the other side, the industry could say that we would like to go in this direction, and the developer should say, okay, we're going to investigate to see if there are any problems with that, and we could say that... everybody wants to make Bitcoin to succeed. I don't think there is anyone that is sinister and say we don't like Bitcoin to succeed, right? That would be very conspiratorial.
I mean the banks don't like Bitcoin. They don't like it.
Yeah, but I don't think banks have much to say, right? They are not even involved in Bitcoin. They have their own little projects, right? So, so in terms of the longest, the chain with the most proof of work behind it, it's the miners together with the Bitcoin industry.
But do you think Bitcoin is too complicated for people to gain trust in it? I mean, to understand, it's very, very difficult to understand Bitcoin.
It's not user-friendly today, but I think that...
But do people need to trust it in that way, that they understand it? Because they don't understand money.
They don't understand money today. Most people don't
just have to gain trust through a sort of... that Bitcoin has been used for many years.
Exactly. It has to be mature, right? Yeah. Before you start believing in it. Because if you know that... You have heard about Bitcoin since 2009. It's still here, right? And it will probably never go away. It will evolve and it will become bigger. There are more transactions. There are more people using it. Eventually, you have a friend who will tell you about this, and he will show it to you, and then that's how trust is built, right?
And some people actually need this currency. So that's also... a path to growth for the currency. Say that everybody wants this to succeed, I don't think so. I mean, there are many...
Everybody in the Bitcoin industry wants to succeed, wants Bitcoin to succeed. I don't think there is anyone working with Bitcoin who says that I want it to not succeed, right?
No.
Because then you would do something else. Mm. You would not actively destroy Bitcoin. That would be foolish, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there are different interests here.
People are, or banks and other companies are... sort of reluctant many times to accept Bitcoin, and they're talking about we need a better system, etc. And they're talking about altcoins like Ethereum, and that's the way it's sort of important to understand this proof of work, I think.
I think that the banks today they are very suspicious to Bitcoin. First of all, because banks normally, as you experience yourself, is that they don't even understand what money is, right? But there are a few who do understand what money is at the bank, and they think it's so important to have a central bank that can always bail them out if something goes wrong or whatever, and or governments that they can always issue more credit or whatever. Because the way money works today, people are so narrow-minded. They only can see this type of money. They can't envision any other kind of system, right?
Yeah.
But I think that Bitcoin is a different kind of money, which is a different system.
Yes.
And it has so many interesting properties that that doesn't share with the traditional money.
Mm.
But Bitcoin doesn't have a central bank because it doesn't need a central bank, and it shouldn't have a central bank because that would be a point of vulnerability. Because that is a point of there would be an attack vector that you can attack it.
Yeah.
So all of this stuff is created as it is because it needs to be secure, and the proof of work is required if you want to have a public blockchain that anybody can participate in.
Yeah.
There is no other way you can do this than using you can use it with proof of stake, but then
some people want to sort of recreate this to become rich or something. copy this.
And oh, there are so many scam coins out there. Yeah,
the latest one was Decreed.
It's ridiculous how many scam coins that's there.
There are many reasons. Yeah. One of them is that they may want a more efficient system, you know, in their minds. But mm-hmm. I'm thinking that proof of work is the ultimate efficiency. As in Bitcoin, the proof of work is directed directly onto the mechanism you want to have executed, which is the transactions, I mean, the confirmation of the transactions in a secure way. So it's very difficult to create a better system.
I would say that the reason why it's a better system, there are two reasons, right? The one is that it's the most secure system, right? Yeah, yeah. Because you can't hack energy. It's very difficult to hack that network, right? Mm. That's one important aspect. The other important aspect is that it forces a gateway to the existing economy, because miners have to pay their electric bills. So they can't keep all their coins. They have to sell some of them. And by doing so, you establish an exchange rate with the existing economy. I mean, there's going to be a transaction between the fiat money and the Bitcoin money.
Yeah, but many sort of critics of this system say that these are weaknesses. But I'd say these are strengths.
Yes, these two things are strengths for the Bitcoin network.
Because it creates a possibility for a truly decentralized system.
Exactly.
The other systems aren't decentralized.
Exactly, because the problem with proof of stake is that the initial stake is given to a group of people, right?
Yeah.
Then are supposed to spread that wealth, but they don't have to.
So
that becomes very centralized. But mining, there are at least, the different kind of miners that come and go, they also change, right? When you look at this hashing power today, you can see all these different miners, right? And they say, oh my God, there are only 10 miners, right? They own the network, right? But what people tend to forget that GHash.io, which was a miner that almost acquired 51%, they're almost gone. They no longer exist today. So there are different kinds of miners that come and go, and that's kind of the beauty with the Bitcoin network, is that the wealth is not always the same group of people all the time that gets the new wealth.
Yeah.
It's a competition that is extremely tough. And if you don't stay ahead, you will get outcompeted by the others.
Yeah.
And that's a very challenging environment to be in.
Yeah.
But with proof of stake, you can just relax and sit on your coins. You don't have to do anything, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes I think the Bitcoin as a currency, as an economic system, is way better than any. I mean, proof of work is definitely needed if you want to create a currency. I'm not saying that proof of stake could have other use cases, but as a currency, proof of work is required.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So Bitcoin, compared to the the current theories, economic theories, like the Keynesian or the Austrian theories?
So the Keynesian theory is a relatively new theory, right? Yeah. 100 years old. And its theory is basically that money creates work. So by bringing new money into the system, you will get work done, right? And it's kind of true in some sense, because I can imagine that, let's say that Satoshi Nakamoto, who has a lot of coins, starts using them. Obviously, he will create work. People will, you know, if he says that I want to go to a restaurant and pay for dinner, then people thought that if he was dead, then the money would be gone, right? But suddenly he comes alive and he creates work. I mean, the restaurants can serve more food and, you know, you get the economy going. And that's the Keynesian theory. But the problem with the Keynesian theory is the other side of the equation. Where does that money come from?
Yeah, yeah.
And in my opinion, money must come from risk. Mm. If it does not, then it's bad money. Then it leads to capital misallocation. And that's precisely what we see today in today's world, where money printing of all the central banks, they go to projects in if you look in China, I mean, they're dead cities, basically, right? They create so much money from nothing. And it's usually state-owned banks or whatever that build these ghost cities that nobody lives in. And that's just that's the problem with the Keynesian theory, right? If you just create money from thin air and there's no risk behind it, then it gets capital misallocation. So Bitcoin, however...
That went haywire in the States.
Yeah, you have to be very careful about doing that. What I like with the other theory, with the Austrian theory, is that if money always is backed by risk, always, it means that when you lend money to someone, you can't create new money. You always have to lend the existing money, the real money that exists in the economy. Then that investor, that lender, takes risk because that person he lends money to may not pay him back. And then that contract defaults.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing because lenders will be careful what they're going to spend their money on, right?
Yeah, that's more of a reality. That's connected to the real world.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just, you know, imagination.
So if you imagine Bitcoin becomes the currency of the planet in some like 30 years from now, then banks will no longer issue credit. They will only act as intermediaries.
They will acquire real money, hard money.
So. Well, what banks will do is they will still be wealthy families.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe there will be different wealthy families from today that have a lot of bitcoins and they want to invest them, right? Mm. So they go to a bank. They don't want to care what kind of companies they want to invest in. So they will just put the money at risk in this bank, knowing that this money can default for an interest rate, and they can re-lend it to different investing in companies, even in private persons, whatever. But the interest rate will reflect the actual risk.
Yeah.
So the problem of today is that the central bank can distort risk by setting a different interest rate than the market.
Yeah.
They could lower it so money becomes cheaper, but that's cheating, right? Because then...
Now we have a negative interest rate.
Well, negative interest rates in terms of deposit rates, right?
Yeah.
So the banks, when they... But of course, normally the lending rate is slightly higher than the deposit rates. And in Sweden, it's 0.75% higher than the deposit rate. So the deposit rate is minus...
But
0.35, and the lending rate is 0.4.
The specifics goes back and forth. But when I talk about why I want to talk about this is because people that criticize Bitcoin often talk about that deflation is a bad thing.
Yeah,
and this is a pretty widespread sort of idea among economists that deflation is terrible for people and the economy and the countries.
Yes.
And I'd like to sort of say that I don't really believe that at all.
I think they are completely wrong because they mix two concepts. There's a distinction between deflation and the cause of deflation. And unfortunately, most economists think they are the same, right?
Yeah.
And there are good deflation, right? The good deflation happens when you have more productivity. Companies become more efficient. And that's very typical in the computer industry. When you buy a computer today, the same computer will be much cheaper.
In a year.
In a year. So
but that, people that, still don't delay their buys.
No, they don't. So the idea that people would delay their investments just because the prices go down is completely wrong. The computer industry disproves that theory, right?
Yeah.
So deflation because of productivity improvements are good. That's good deflation, and then that doesn't affect anything. The bad deflation is if there's a natural disaster or a company goes down and money disappears and because of services disappears, the prices go down. The prices go down because there's something bad happening in the economy.
Yeah. Like in the 30s in the States. You know.
Yeah, and that's deflation because something bad is happening in the economy. In that case, deflation is just an indicator that something bad is going on.
Mm.
And then I would say there's neutral deflation.
Mm.
And that's deflation. If you would imagine you have a fixed money supply, then if productivity in the world goes up, I mean, if more services are created, there will be a slight price deflation.
Yeah, your currency should be more valued.
It doesn't matter because if it's a unit of account and there's a slight price deflation, then it's going to be neutral because it's not going to be bad. It happens because you know there are more services being provided. It's the same thing that a computer gets cheaper. But this is neutral.
But
computers is productivity improvement.
Yeah, but most central bank bosses, they want to sort of keep the inflation at a certain rate, at 2% usually, or 3%.
I think that's
an economic theory.
That's an economic theory.
That's been testing for so many years now. And it doesn't work because it just transfers money from the people that are only having currencies, they don't own other stuffs like properties or gold,
so
to the rich people.
No, so the inflation theory, I think, comes from Keynesian economy, where they think that
creating
new money will also create economic activity. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's true.
Yeah.
But the problem is that if money comes from nowhere, it's not associated with risk. Then you get capital misallocation. So I think
if everybody were exactly the same as rich as everybody else, then it would be probably a pretty good system.
So there's this talk about helicopter money now, but I don't know. I don't believe in any of that thing. I think it's perfectly viable to have an economic system where the money supply is fixed, as in Bitcoin. And then the lending, when you lend money, the interest rate would reflect the actual risk.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing because that will prevent capital misallocation. Now, some would say that this will stifle economy. I think that's, no, it's not going to stifle because people want to eat food. They need to buy food to survive. So something has to exchange in order to get the economy going. So I don't believe in that. And by the way, it has been zero inflation now for the last couple of years. Nothing bad is happening. Productivity in Sweden
in
is pretty
area.
Good, actually. I mean, economic growth is like 2-3%. I mean,
in the States,
too,
right now.
Yeah.
But this episode was about what is Bitcoin. Then we delved into what is money more than we delved into what is Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But let's just talk a bit more about what Bitcoin is, because there's also this so-called blockchain where you can sort of timestamp information into the blockchain, and you could and can write smart contracts. This is programmable money, Bitcoin, compared to other types of money. These are totally new features. There've never been these kind of features in any type of money ever before invented, right?
Correct.
So it's a new type of money, and it's not like the other types of money.
Yes.
It's a totally new kind of money.
It's a totally new kind of money, precisely as the central bank money was also a totally new kind of money in 1694.
Yeah. So we have 1694, and then we have 2008.
Yeah. So the definition of money is going to change, and it has changed, and it's going to continue changing, right? But this concept of programmable money in Bitcoin has an extremely interesting property, because one of the things that Bitcoin enables is that you can create derivatives that are fully backed.
This is very interesting.
Yeah, the derivatives that are fully backed.
I think we should sort of talk about derivatives.
Yeah.
But maybe the next episode.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's going to be in episode 3.
And I'd like to talk more about the blockchain and sort of the so-called idea of notarizing or timestamping.
Yes.
Providing provenance on unique properties, etc. And in the last episode, I talked about the blockchain. What is the blockchain as a word? And I said that Satoshi Nakamoto did not mention the word blockchain in his white paper, which is true, but he did mention it in the code.
In the source code, client, yeah.
In the source code.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So the word blockchain, the word blockchain,
it's not frequently. It's infrequent, yeah. But there is a class called blockchain, and there is there's a comment says blockchain, and so it's a very implicit concept in his source code, I would say. So he was very fully aware about what it was and what it was supposed to do.
And right now, the blockchain is so popular, it's so trendy. Any IT company or any self-respecting fintech company or financial company are looking into the blockchain as a technology. They say this technology drives Bitcoin, and you can copy it and do other things with it.
Yes.
Whatever.
You can do other things with it, but you cannot do currencies. That's my opinion on it.
Yeah. But you can timestamp stuff. You can create transparency and provenance, for instance. So authorities should love the blockchain in the long run when they start to understand it. I mean,
yeah. So the interesting aspect is that
although they can demand more transparency from companies, private companies.
Although Bitcoin is money, it's a currency, it can also do other things. You can use the blockchain. You can use the money not as money but as tokens for something else, right? And because it's programmable, you can encode things in these tokens to do something else.
Yeah.
So
if people agree on that, that's derivative part also.
No. But what I'm saying is that you can use a token to say that I'm gonna use this transaction to prove that a picture was taken at a particular time, right?
Yeah.
So you can encode, you can take the digital signature of a picture or photograph, and you can embed that in a transaction using only monetary transactions are allowed. So you need to have some money spent, but when you do that, you can encode other things in that transaction. For instance, a digital signature of something that has occurred in the real world. So that gives you use of the Bitcoin blockchain to do other things. And because Bitcoin blockchain is impossible to fake, it becomes a public history, a perfect track record that something has happened.
Yeah.
And it's kind of similar to what, you know, when you get kidnapped or something, you have this... You take the daily newspaper next to the person and take a photograph to prove that this happened at this time.
Yeah.
You can do that with the blockchain as well, right? You don't need a newspaper anymore. You take the picture, you take the signature of that picture, you put it into a transaction of the blockchain, and then you can prove that this occurred at least at this time, right?
It's going to be interesting to see if that has any real value, any big value, that function or that mechanism going forward. Because, you know, the currency in Bitcoin has a real mechanism, a real value.
Yeah.
That part, I mean, there are sort of many people talking about notarizing in the blockchain, which is maybe totally unnecessary. But, you know, let's go into that in the next episode.
Sure.
Because I'm pretty satisfied with our talk about what is Bitcoin, what is money. You can talk about it for, like, how many... an endless amount of hours, because it's very interesting. What is money? Money drives makes the world go round, more or less. But I'd like to just talk about a few things that has happened over the last week, sort of the news, which is, for instance, Ripple. What is Ripple? For Ripple is a sort of a copy with totally other rules than Bitcoin. You have a ring of nodes or judges that are selected. These nodes are selected by a central authority. They get to vote on what happens in this currency. And then you have a central authority you can attack, okay? So what happened with Ripple? Ripple started many years ago, and they've sort of tried to sell themselves to banks or authorities as a sort of IOU system, where you send sort of notes to each other in the system. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying to sort of convince authorities that this is a better system than Bitcoin. But what happens, then they sort of crash onto the judicial system, and because of the KYC rules, you know your customer rules, the authorities will absolutely, of course, require KYC sort of regulatory standards from any company they can do it from. So if you have a central person in the top, so now Ripple has discontinued the Ripple trade service, where you could sort of
buy and sell ripples
between each other.
Yeah.
This is because they can't stand up to the KYC rules, of course. So they got this request from the authorities. Yeah, well, do you know who you're transacting with? Everybody in the Voluntary system have to make an identification for each person, and they can't do that, of course.
Yeah.
So they have to close down. And this will happen with any kind of currency, when they're trying to
expose it outside their own world, right?
Yeah, and have a mechanism for transferring value.
Yeah.
If you do something else, if you like registering your assets somehow, you could probably do that.
Yeah.
But the authorities are not going to allow.
Well, authorities are going to regulate that too. If you use tokens to transact bonds, I mean, governments are going to say, we want to have a final word in this, right? Of course. So
Ripple now has lost 35% of its value over the last week, for instance. And I don't really, I'm just surprised that there's so few people seem to understand this part. These currencies, this called blockchain stuff, won't work together with KYC.
I'm pretty sure
if you want to do a value transferring mechanism.
If you want to have a currency or money, I don't think there's any future in having a private company trying to create a network or a system that will act as money, because governments will always stifle and get in their way. So they will not be productive, and there will always be rules and regulations that they have to think about in order to become a licensed money supplier, right? So I think that path is going to be extremely difficult. It's never going to happen. All these projects will fail eventually.
No.
If they become big enough, they will fail, right? And the reason why Bitcoin has value is because there's no central authority. I mean, nobody controls it. And so governments have no choice. They can't talk to anyone, right? They can't talk to, I mean, Satoshi. Even if Satoshi Nakamoto is found,
he can't change the rules.
Maybe the third
Bitcoin.
Time he will, I don't know.
Yeah.
But if it's found, governments, doesn't matter if governments talk to him, he can't do anything.
No,
it has nothing to do with that. There's no central point of authority in Bitcoin. And all these companies, I mean, Ripple, I think, was trying to push their technology to banks, but banks themselves have formed their own company called R3CEV, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which will basically do exactly what Ripple wants them
to do. Yeah, wanted to do. Yeah, they're going to do the same thing again. Yeah.
So banks no longer need Ripple. They have their own system. So why should they use Ripple? I think that could be an issue why Ripple has been crashing. Is that there's no bright future, because banks are already inventing their own system.
Well, they're not really inventing anything. They're just grasping after sort of somehow to get the hold of this technology.
Well, whatever they do, it's not going to be money or currency, because all the banks, when they issue credit, all that stuff is backed by a central bank.
Yeah.
So the only institutions that can do anything that has to do with electronic money is the central bank.
But do you think people in the banking system will understand this during 2016? What do you think this will take a longer time? 2017, 18, 19?
I think neither central banks nor private banks, no one really understand how this system works, except for a very few, that has a very good training and education in monetary theory and history that understands money. I mean, most people who works in bank, they don't understand money. I mean, it's
because this is the sort of beginning of the year, so people do these predictions. For instance, in CoinDesk, they have this article called 16 Blockchain Tech Predictions for 2016, where they sort of a guy called Andrew Keys, he's the director of communications at Consensus, some sort of consultancy in the blockchain industry. Sort of, he says that Ethereum will win the day. Many who use the terms blockchain or distributed ledger will learn they actually meant Ethereum. But I'm saying that Ethereum, as their plan is to use proof of stake, which we have debunked proof of stake already. Proof of stake won't work. So during this, do you think that insight will propagate the banking world this year or next year? Will Ethereum sort of die this year or next year? That's an interesting.
I think that banks are struggling to use some kind of, they want to find a use case for blockchain technology. That's kind of interesting. They have some abstract, vague idea that blockchain can be used to trade bonds or whatever. The problem, however, that I see with these systems is that because banks are under law, right? They are regulated under law, and judges in every country wants to have the final word on the judicial system has the final word on everything. So it means that whatever thing they come up with, a central authority has to be able to go and change things in it. And the blockchain is, according to my, in my opinion, is all about making something that is very difficult to change. So they're trying to struggle with a world where there's very difficult to change and try to unite that with a world where everything should be able to be, everything should be, it should be possible to change anything. So trying to reconcile that, it's going to be very difficult. I don't really see how that's going to go to play out that well, really.
In our last episode, we talked about if a cryptocurrency could be a sovereign sort of currency. But and there's in the related news, there's a site called theblockchain.com, Tunisia to replace its national digital currency, e-dinar, with blockchain-driven monetas currency. This is a headline I just read out.
Yeah.
So these are attempts, sort of, from a number of people at certain companies to change into a blockchain-driven currency.
So what they want is basically, can a central bank create a blockchain kind of currency instead?
Yeah.
And in my opinion, no, they can't, okay? So there are central, there are these sovereign currency, e-currencies, but they are not blockchain-based. They are like M-Pesa in Kenya. That you have accounts with identification. And the reason why accounts need identification is that if something goes wrong, you have to make sure that you can correct it, right? And cash is not about identity, right? Cash, real cash, is that I can transact without anyone in the world knowing what I'm using my money for, right? And that's going to be a problem. So you will lose all transparency. You're going to lose all privacy if these kind of systems go ahead. And I don't think people like that, because you will get too much power of the state. What happens if the state says that you are a terrorist and let's say and you are innocent and they will froze all your money? You will be frozen out completely, right? You can't even eat or even get a lawyer or pay a lawyer or whatever. All of that stuff, that's just too much power for a state, for a government. So it's a good thing that you have privacy, that you can transact, you have money, you have the ability to do things. And in certain parts of the world, the state can be very oppressive, right? Or repressive. So that it's very important that this freedom exists, that there is a privacy, that you can transact, you can interact with people without the government knowing everything, right? The big brother society.
We are very distrustful against any government. I mean, let's say there's a government arising that we sort of want to trust and that they want to use a blockchain for good things.
Well,
we usually sort of...
So the thing here is that an M-Pesa-like system or an e-currency-like system where you have unit of accounts, you have identification, and you have a central bank and can do transactions, is not a blockchain type of currency.
It's a database.
It's a database where you transact things. And yes, all central banks in the world can do this, and some are looking into that.
Yeah,
this is not the first example. You have Ecuador, right?
Yeah.
But this is not blockchain based. As soon as you go blockchain, and if you try to have something that is anonymous, that you can't tie a specific individual or an account to a certain token, then it won't work.
No, but it's interesting that the media, the headlines on certain pages, are saying things that's impossible in the real world. It won't happen, but the media or the journalists writing this don't really understand this. And there's another trend tying into this.
Yeah.
Wired have been publishing many dubious articles in this area. This is one called "The Plan to Unite Bitcoin with All Other Online Currencies." And we've had several projects like that.
Yeah.
It's Hyperledger, Interledger, or there's Settle, and there's a couple of ones where they want to create sort of a base layer for all the currencies of the banks or the altcoins or the nations, etc. And there is no point to that at all, and it won't work. And this is because
they have you don't have control over all the networks, right? So it's all voluntarily based. If you want to transact and exchange between things, that's what you do at exchanges, right? You exchange fiat money for another thing. That's done at exchanges. So I would just imagine that exchanges can add more cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, I'm thinking about sort of incentives. Who is behind these initiatives? Where's the greed? Who is going to make money from it? I don't understand really at all why somebody wants to create this.
Now, but
if you go back, who's going to make money from it? They have to expend time and work to make it work. How are they going to recoup the investment?
Yeah, so first of all, I don't believe in other altcoins.
No.
I think Bitcoin is the only one that is viable for currency.
So those people who are creating these sort of systems, they believe in altcoins?
I think that they believe in altcoins because they themselves will get rich. Because they start with something like a proof-of-stake system,
they
will get rich. Yeah. And
like R3CEV, the blockchain stuff they're creating, is just an altcoin if you think about it. An altcoin with probably no value.
Well, it's not going to be
for settlement.
It's not going to be an altcoin because people are not going to use it. It's just the banks.
Well,
but
the banks are people. I mean, money.
But it's never going to go outside the banksware. That's what I'm saying. It's going to stay inside the banksware.
But it's still an altcoin. It's still a copy of Bitcoin. It's just maybe a couple of years ago, in 2013 and 14, we had loads and loads and loads of altcoins being created by people.
Yeah.
But now the banks are doing exactly the same things as the amateurs did like 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh,
they're creating their own altcoins. They're just calling it blockchain and settlement and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, we had Ripple, we had Stellar, we had Ethereum, and...
Yeah, so
doesn't really matter. No?
So if we go back to the government, if they try to create, why they can't create a blockchain type of currency is because the anonymity aspect of it. If governments are able to create money, which I assume they would like to, because otherwise they could just use Bitcoin, then that if they can't track where that money goes, what every account is, they can't reverse the transactions then, because that could hurt the economy, right? It could be that a company, let's say, a car company or whatever, has a lot of wealth being stolen if they try to reverse those anonymous accounts, right? And if you have money that is too risky to reverse and you can create new money, what happens if a hacker gets inside the Federal Reserve, creates $10 trillion of dollars, and in a number of seconds they spread it to millions of different accounts, and they start using the money and
yeah, that risk in itself would probably stop that development.
Yeah, so I think that a Federal Reserve anonymous currency is never going to happen because that's too risky. A Federal Reserve non-anonymous currency can happen.
Like a Fed coin, yeah.
Like a Fed, but then it's not going to be blockchain-based. It's not going to be anonymous cash anymore.
No,
it's going to be M-Pesa or eDiner or whatever it's going to called. It's going
to
be...
Because we define blockchain as something that has to be permissionless, decentralized, open. Anybody has to be able to connect to it, right?
Yeah, well... That's what I see.
Blockchain with a big capital B, the blockchain.
If you want to use a blockchain for currency, I would say yes, right? If you mean that if you can identify all accounts and you can reverse things, it's completely useless to use a blockchain. You use a database where you can you can just change the balances of every identity of every person.
Mm.
There's no point in doing another system, a more complicated system.
I think we've come back to the starting point here, more or less.
Yeah, what is money?
Yeah. So I think we should wrap it up. And thank you very much for this episode.
I'm glad to be here.
If you have any specific questions, dear listeners, you'd like us to address, please send an email to me. The address is nanook@nanook.com, or interact with me on Twitter. My username is Nanook, that's N-A-N-O-K, or interact with Datavetaren on Twitter, which is Datavetaren is Datavetaren. That's Datavetaren on Twitter. And I'd also like to just make a shout out to Bitcoin Uncensored. If you're going to listen to only two podcasts on Bitcoin, you listen to this one and Bitcoin Uncensored. Those guys are great. And if you want to read up on the formula, the so-called formula, the Bitcoin formula that this podcast is named after, then you go to thebitcoinformula.com. And that's about it. So right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Till the next podcast, or next episode. Bye-bye. Take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.